with Kevin Sheridan on 7 March 78.
Well, following the successful testing of the 97 negative model of the North Cross, Graham Rolls and Ross Boyd and others, and then sort of looked for a new site for a much bigger cross, and I was given the job then of actually finding a site. And I flew all over New South Wales and played over country quite a lot on my aerial map of the first site, which we finally selected.
And that's the remnants of the airfield there.
That's right. That's an old an Air Force field. In fact, when we first came in among all these trees, there were evidence of camouflage nets and all the paraphernalia of them.
That can't be seen now, I don't think, the runways here.
The runway probably still can. I haven't been out for some years. Now, the last time the answer was yes, we used to drive along the runway to get to the site, actually.
Oh, I see.
And so I'm sure you could find evidence.
Well, I was out there Sunday. Maybe I was driving along the runway and didn't realize it.
That's quite possible. It would be pretty ancient now. I guess it wouldn't actually be much use. But in those days, it was quite navigable. In fact, we landed on it and looked around. Then we negotiated with the owner and set up the site for the 85.
Were your main requirements simply that it be very flat and free of interference?
Yes, we wanted certainly the flatness over an extended area, because the ends of the cross were going to be quite long, 1,500 feet, I think, which in those days was considerable length, and it needed to be flat and a non-flat area and all that sort of thing. But typical of all radio astronomy sites, so when I was making the first contact with the owner, and he said, "What would you want to do?" I told him, and he was very interested because he had a son, I think, at the time, who was a pilot with Canadian Airlines, and so he was interested in science the same time when he knew that we hadn't done working radio navigation. He was even more cooperative. But when we went out, we bogged his car in the centre. That seems to be typical of what we do. Later, the site for Caldera, exactly the same thing happened.
Really?
Mr. Bourne then was quite agreeable to letting us hire some of the area, and so Bernie Mills, Horsey, and everybody else then got behind it, and I think you probably heard the story from Bernie, and there's a few old photographs of the site. I was mainly concerned with helping them to design the electronic equipment.
So you were more on the receiver end than the antenna?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Alec Little looked at the antenna, and I tended to look at the equipment. And this was the photograph of the 85 megahertz system.
Mm-hmm. Who was this in the visit?
Oh, no, that was a chap from our workshop who was allocated to help me with the building up of the equipment. That's a chap called Ken Hawkins. He was a great help, and he stayed more or less with us until he retired.
Now, the Shane Cross was not there yet.
That's right. The Shane Cross came a bit later.
Right.
And again, Alex Shane was helped by Alec Little in the design of the aerial system, and once again I was asked to help on the...
I see. You worked on the receiver?
So we built that for him.
And who is this?
Oh, that's Bruce Lee. He popped in there for the... Bruce, of course, was associated quite early with the 85, because he wanted somebody with Bruce's knowledge of radio astronomy to help him with analysis. And Bruce came in quite early after we had things more or less partly working.
Well, tell me what problems you encountered in making this receiver and so forth.
Well, here's one of the sort of problems. I seem to be hacking on. Vehicle being bogged, but that's the early stages of the Shane Cross.
This is you and Bruce Lee.
That's right, and Alec Little. That's Alec Little there. Bruce Lee, a chap called Les Clegg, who was helping.
Pulling out this truck.
This was our little wagon that we used to drive along under the aerials and measurements.
This wasn't posed, huh?
That wasn't bad. It was typical of the work that one had to do in those days to get things going.
This is part of the...
That's part of the chain.
Chain array, yes.
It doesn't photograph very well because it's just really a series of posts and single wires.
Those posts are still standing out there.
Oh, they're still there, yes. Oh, in fact, I think the Sydney University people, Larry Finlay, I think, redesigned it, I think, and made it work somewhere near 30 megahertz.
That's right, there was some evidence of that. Yeah. I mean, they made a survey with that.
That's right, yes, and a very good survey, too.
So, but more electronically oriented, what were the receiver problems?
Oh, well, in those days, the chief problem, I suppose, was stability. One wanted the system to run night and day without drifting very much. One wanted low noise receivers with valves, and then one looked for a recording system which would multi-channel, if you like, in declination. So the chief problems were just really stability of, of gain, stability of timing. We used decatron tubes and crystal oscillators to count down, so we introduced a few of those sort of ideas to make it all work. But other than that, there wasn't.
The switching between different arms and so forth, did that create any problems from your point of view? Or?
You mean the multiplication?
Right.
Yes, we had to make sure that the balance of the switch was very good, and that was another problem, sure. Also, in those days, square law detectors were just sort of marginal, and one did a lot of work on those, and finished up with quite interesting one, of course, by Suzuki. I guess you've got Suzuki on
the list. He's on my list. I haven't talked to him yet.
Had published a square law detector rather novel lines where you use an IF amplifier and then you put a frequency doubler in, and then you detect it linearly, and the output of that detector is then proportional to the square of the voltage that just comes from the doubling frequency.
Uh-huh.
So we had two types of square law detectors in those days. His came along and finally we used in the same class. But we developed one of our own out of multi-grid valves and things for the
84
So I think really the main problems there were just stability and good balance and reliable operation.
How long did it take to build the receiver and the antenna?
Oh, I suppose, I'm guessing here. About a year, I suppose, in that order. Alec might have a better appreciation of how long.
I'll be talking to him tomorrow, actually.
Yes, he might really know more than that. I would say we spent about a year, I guess, getting it all together. And then perhaps a few months polishing it off. And it worked fairly well. It was a fairly tame sort of system.
I get the idea that the... once you have the basic idea, it wasn't that difficult to build in terms of really new technology.
Yes.
Cleverness was in the original
system. Very much so. It's the initial concept of the journeys and subsequent development of it is, and entirely on the journeys guidance, really, and ideas in those days. He took it, of course, naturally a personal interest in the whole development of it, and was always on hand for discussions and advice and that sort of thing.
Was he out there working on the receiver and the antenna himself, or mainly supervising?
Mainly supervising. He left the technical details to us, but when it came to actual testing of the system, yes, he came out then and was very interested in following up and interviewing new techniques himself in that sense.
But it was mainly you and Little working on it?
Oh, yeah, we more or less looked after the details, if you like.
Right.
The details
Well, when this thing began taking drift scans of the sky, you, of course, began to get some interesting data, and the first publications were in 56 that you were associated with by yourself, Little, and Mills.
Yes.
And For instance, you looked at some supernovae remnants and some novae.
That's right. I remember that.
And only detected Kepler's star, or that was even not sure that you had detected it.
It was probable detection of that. Probably the more interesting one was the emission nebula.
Right, the absorption.
Absorption.
On NGC 6357.
Right, yes, I think that was one of the exciting discoveries of that stage. It was an original one.
Right. Well, now, in the abstract, you say this was the first time an absorption had been seen against an H2 region.
Yes.
And I was wondering, relative to the work that Ryle and, was it Scheuer or Shakeshaft? Anyway, they had a survey a couple of years before this showing absorption in the galactic plane.
Oh, yes.
Which they ascribed to H2 regions, but maybe the point was that that wasn't really established. It was just that they interpreted it that way, or not.
I'm not sure whether they were talking about the galactic absorption that was quite apparent at 19 megahertz,
right,
the object of the paper when Alexander died, Max von Sydow.
Right. Yes, that's what they were talking about.
I think they're probably talking about galactic absorption. This was the first time in an emission nebula. As such, and not really the whole.
But the one is the integrated effect of the other, is it not?
Well,
was it just the case that here you had a specific object that you could see that was?
I think that was it. It was the it was possible to make an estimate of the electron temperature of that particular object.
Right, right. Yes.
I think we found it was very low compared to the sort of 10,000 degree electron temperature you might expect. The temperature went down, I think, to about 6,500.
Right. But then in a later article in Australian Journal of Physics, where you had looked at 14 nebulae,
yeah,
you found about half an emission and only that same one in absorption.
That's right.
And the others came out to temperatures of more like 10,000 Kelvin, so that turned out to be an unusual case, I guess.
Right, I think the conclusion from that one was that you could apply the ordinary theories of radiation from ionized gas to those sort of things. There wasn't anything different in the mechanism.
Yeah. But also, of course, the point of the controversy at that time was the origin of the galactic background.
Yes.
And in your one paper, you argued that it could not be due to the integrated effect of novae, but it might be the integrated effect of supernovae.
Yes. I think that Bernie then wrote quite a few more papers on that subject himself, and I think perhaps it would be better really to talk to Bernie.
But it seemed like you were not thinking of an extended sort of origin of sort of radiation, rather the integrated effect of discrete.
Yes, I think possibly in these early papers they were more of an exploratory nature. We had the new instrument we were looking for, we were testing it and we were looking at things. The program itself was one that Penny himself had thought up, and these were some of the early results.
Mm-hmm.
Later I became more interested in the in analysis of some of the extended sources, especially Centaurus and Fornax.
Well, speaking of Centaurus, actually you had an earlier paper in 55 with Divocaluris, of
right,
all people.
Yes. Well, that
How did that come about?
Well, while we were testing the Willis cross, and before we really had it, before we had all bugged out of it, we looked at Centaurus, and Divocaluris was around at the time, and he was extremely interested in doing an optical comparison. He had the use of the storm lab facilities, and
what do you mean he was around? Was he actually visiting radio physics?
I think he actually was visiting Stromlo. I think he actually might have been working there for years.
Oh, at Stromlo, right.
Yes, Alias, and of course we knew him. He came down several times to the laboratory, and he was very much interested in the cross, and so it was just a cooperative, just as a result, I think, of one of his visits where he may have mentioned he was working on it, and we also mentioned we were working on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got together, and it wasn't the best set of observation that the cross was capable of at the time. It was just the first one, as we produced this, this comparison between the optical isotopes. Because nowadays they take them out over many degrees, but in those days he was only able to sort of trace it out to about 2 degrees. And then by smoothing his results with the, without being, we were able to show then that that the narrow dimension of the source, the optical and the radio emissions were followed similar sorts of laws, but the long extension in the north-south direction, there was an obvious deviation. It was quite clear that the radio source had a much greater extended background, and that showed up straight away. And of course, that's really the thing about Centaurus, it turned out to be such a marvelous source, and it still is today.
Still understand. But was he able to follow the optical out to 2 degrees, you say? That seems surprising to me.
Well, I just checked, I'll be able to answer that. I had an idea that the main isotopes were now within a six minute region. We only followed, when I say that, we only made the comparison. It should be noted that only 2 degrees of the extended source have the total length of over 6 degrees I used here. That is, we didn't take our observations out any further than that. They could receive the deviation here. They would stop at about 60 minutes. So we were looking for high signal to noise for the comparison, and we didn't go out right over the...
Right, but now, this is all radio, or is this... Oh, I see. NDC 5128 is dash.
That's the optical nebula, and this is the...
So he actually did follow it to a degree radius. Yeah.
Yes. He got about... which wasn't too bad for
that. Indeed, yes. Well, and then in the Australian Journal of Physics in 58, you published Niels Cross maps of Centaurus, Fornax, and Puppis.
Yes.
And what was it looking like as you got these maps?
I found that extremely interesting because it was a project that he gave me to do by myself. And so I took the observations and reduced them. And the paper described the results. I think the source itself just turned out to be such a big, interesting one. In those days, there was some doubt as to whether it was actually joined to the galaxy. I think Piddington and McGee and others had already done it with 600 gigs, and it looked as though maybe there was a link between the galaxy and Centaurus, but that didn't seem to turn up in much good case. Oh, I think the sheer physical size of it, first really accurate, I suppose, at that time, flux density measurements of the big source.
Yeah.
And the comparison with Fornax and Centaurus, it was just
incredible. And they didn't show much structure with the resolution
you had? No, the resolution, it wasn't enough to really do show the structure.
So what?
There were some suggestions, but nothing different.
49 arc minutes or something like that?
Yes, I made a table up of it, of the sizes, and made some estimates of the digital size.
Well, is there anything else in connection with the Niels Cross from your point of view that I should know before we switch to NAPTO?
No, I think it was just, it was a very interesting project. I really enjoyed working on it, and at that particular time when it was working, and people like Bruce Lee, Bernie and Alec were then kept on that project, and I was asked to move it down into another field to help with the running development and expansion perhaps of NAPTO, which was a solid project.
Now, when you say you were asked, it was not something that you came up with. It was something rather that...
Yes, I think at the time, Paul Wild was overseas, and Jim Roberts was running NAPTO in those days, and Jim was looking for some assistance. I think John Murray, who actually had done most of the work with Bill Rowe, I think he was John Murray, I think had been extracted, if you like, from that to work with Dick McGee at another field station, Murray Bank, on mine work. And so that day was without much technical help at that stage. And I think Tim Roberts may have, you could check with him, but I think Tim was the task force, I think, couldn't he get some help? And anyway, I was given the opportunity of doing that.
I guess from the point of view of technical help at the Mills Cross, that wasn't needed so much. It was running and
working and so forth. That's right, and I think they probably thought the same thing, that the tattoo was really a high priority job. That's a difficult sort of system to keep going. And they also had plans for expansion and so on. So I guess that was what was in Porzi's mind. He was very keen on solar observations. Plurs didn't really do any solar observations, although we did it one or two occasions, managed to get some observations of someone who didn't want them. On one occasion, Bruce Slee might recall us, we were observing, we were testing the equipment, and Bruce actually had it on during the day, and we got a tremendous soil burst, which was just, as far as we were concerned, just a nuisance. And it was not wanted, so the record was just crumbled up and thrown in a waste paper basket. And then when we got back to the lab, we used to drive backwards and forwards in those days from Perth back to the lab. We heard that there had been a tremendous cosmic ray event, and that Perth, and the first update was underwater, I think there was a flood or something. And there was just no solar record, and so we remembered this one, and we put a phone call through and rescued this old planet record. And Steve Smoot had the job of extracting some information from it, so I suppose we'd call that a solar observation.
But anyway, when you got to Dapto now, what was the situation there?
Oh, well, Dapto was a much greater distance from Sydney. It was 70 or 80 miles away, and so one had to go and spend time down there. You couldn't really go down and come back in the same day. The setup at that time was that the station had been built, and there was a spectrograph working between 40 and 220, I think, megahertz. There was a local technical person, Jack Joyce, who came in every day. He lived quite close by, and he came in, he operated the equipment. Tim Roberts was at that stage looking after it, and Max Komisarov, I think, also was taking observations, but nobody was actually working on keeping the equipment in good shape. It was a very difficult piece of equipment to keep going. It was a dynamic thing. It was running all the time with condensers. In those days, electronic tuning was only just on the horizon. So it was really a mechanical monster of sorts to sort of keep it all going properly. But it was nevertheless rather very well designed, and of course it had all the earmarks of Paul Weil, Samuel Lavers, and his original thinking and his original approach to all these sort of problems.
Which specifically do you think of as those earmarks?
Paul was just unique. He, in designing the spectrograph, he overcame this many problems, one after the other. Broadband aerials, broadband receivers, the dynamic range, the recording of these birds, the analysis of it. Anything that was a problem was just worked on until it was no longer a problem. Mm-hmm. It all has that remarkable facility of seeing the problem and staying with it until you spread a solution. It's just quite amazing to work with him. But at that stage, it was really, there was nothing very difficult to fix up. It was just that somebody was needed to look into some of these problems and to think about some of the possible extensions. And I got very, very interested in it because I found it a great challenge. The dynamic nature of the solar activity appealed to me enormously. You had to have all the equipment going. You just didn't know when things were going to come. You just had to be ready for them. So you had to have a system working well most of the time if you wanted to get good results.
Right.
My thoughts were powerfully in line with, of course, the early thoughts that one should extend the operation of the speaker out as far as possible, and so it seemed to me fairly easy to send it down until the ionosphere cut it off. And so that was what we did first. Well, Gil Trent, of course, I forgot to mention Gil Trent, he was the other technical person who would come down from Sydney, and he would help work on the equipment in Sydney, and then he would come down. And so Gil and I helped with the actuaries, and with assistance from Jim Roberts, gradually extended the range down until, in fact, we had it running right down to 5 megahertz.
Down to 5? Yes.
Well, we ran the receiver down to 5 finally, and we had all that recorded on 3 cathode ray tubes and 3 separate 35mm films.
It's required new antennas also.
Yes, it required new antennas. Again, that was another thing that Paul was extremely good at. He'd sort of just taken the theory of Romdix that had been developed by Christensen. Christensen had been working on antennas for overseas telecommunications people. I think he had written his thesis or part of his thesis on that sort of thing. So he had quite a lot of information, and Paul just adapted that in his inimitable way until he had not only the bandwidth and things he wanted, but the polarization as well built into it. But for extending downwards, we decided not to worry about polarization, we just concentrated on the spectrum itself. And it was very exciting watching these bursts, which we could see were actually coming right to the end of our range. We could see they were stopping, and then you'd go and see how much further they'd go, and see how much further they'd go. And until finally we were actually seeing a cutoff in the record. You could see these electric strong type trees coming down, stopping at a certain frequency. And over a period of time, we had quite a number of records, so I related the lowest frequency as measured on the spectrograph to the lowest expected frequency, assuming that it was an ionospheric cutoff. And we were able to say maybe it was Charlie Atwood. Well, another chap had come on to help me, and those days was Charlie Atwood, who was now working here also. And so we wrote a paper on that, just sort of saying, which was obvious, I suppose, that the ionosphere was cutting off, and that you would expect to get any more if you could get outside the ionosphere. And so it was only just in time, really, because satellites were already sort of starting, but perhaps it wasn't known just how far they would go and how good they were. And as a smaller side, it was interesting in those days to speculate on what sort of an ionospheric cutoff machine a spectrograph could make. That is, you could actually use a spectrograph like that to learn something about the cutoff of the ionosphere without actually having
sound. A radar.
As I can gather, no practical use at the moment anyway, but it could be
done. You don't have to wait
for
a verse.
That's right. Almost, I suppose, concurrently with those developments, Paul was very interested in getting position measurements of these bursts. And perhaps the most exciting development then was the swift frequency interferometer, which had the principles of being sound direct by Paul and Jim Roberts when they were using it for all the scintillation of radio stars like Cygnus and things like that. But it wasn't in any sort of a form to do really good solar measurements. So we spent quite a lot of time getting the interferometer on both the long and short phase line.
Did they use an interferometer for the Cygnus scintillation?
Yes.
Oh, I'd forgotten.
Yes. So the problems there were how to follow the sun, how to compensate for the delays and the path differences that the sun moved. And that was again another example of Paul's very, I suppose you'd call it direct approach to visual problems. There was no trouble at all for Paul to think up a system of lines out in space which were just equal to the path differences and to actually make that sort of thing work. And that was what we had this network of lines which were directly switched in the RF circuits.
Mm-hmm.
things which perhaps a radio engineer would shudder at, but Paul would make all these sort of things work. I mean, he said, well, this is the right way to do it. Why, you know, you just do it this way, and so you make switches and things and tell you how it's all working like that.
Why would the radio engineer shudder?
I would think that radio engineers would look for a solution, perhaps in terms of delay lines and things in the IF and things like that, but Paul put them straight in the broadband signal part of the broadband interferometer.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the analysis of that type of system, how you offset the white wave and use the scissor action of the layers of the function frequency, was all nicely worked out by Paul. So we just made that work, and that was very exciting. I had my old book. Oh, if you're just switching for a moment, I don't suppose you're interested in the Fleur's notebook, but that's just a book of the technical things.
Oh, yes, I'd like to take a look at this.
I just like, I don't think you'll find anything with any. I think it's just my notes of the time and sex, but you're welcome to have one too. I was just looking at some of the records that we took over adding and modifying interferometer that we made.
Right.
Well, these are published in the paper. You might just like to look at some of the others that we had. The normal spectrograph was running, of course, simultaneously for this one. For the interferometer, we had both an adding interferometer and a modifying interferometer, and we put them on alternately. So here's the burst going through, you've got to see the fringes,
mm-hmm.
the visibility function. Obtained directly from a record of that type, and here's the equivalent position information.
I see.
Page. And that was it was very pleasing to see that type of record. We had to look through little holes in the cathode ray display to see them, because we were photographing and we couldn't actually see the record until the film had been developed. But nevertheless, you could deduce a lot by a quick peep at the thing to see that it was all working.
Mm-hmm.
And we found that very exciting, watching these tapes.
How far apart are these in time?
They're 1 second. The clock's 1 second. So we tended to put them on like that. And also the aerials could be connected to polarization in a similar way. That is, we could substitute the cross feeds, and instead of getting position information, we could get the modulation due to circular polarization function frequency. So as a result of these early measurements, it was clear that we had the spacings and the system parameters right for measuring these types of bursts. We had a kilometre baseline in those days, but we didn't have enough to eliminate the delay of ambiguity. So the second step then was to put in a short baseline interferometer, and we alternately switched between that and the long baseline. And we also introduced, instead of this, we thought it would be nice to have a real-time record. And so we introduced the facsimile type of display.
Yes, I was just reading about that in your 63 review article, the facsimile.
I'm just switching back and forth. There's another picture of some
radio
astronomers at Perth.
Oh, that's a great photo.
That's
yeah.
Chap Ken Hawkins, and that's Alex Shane. Bruce Lee, Ken Mills, me, Alex Little, and that's Henry Risper, who you may know from England.
Do you know where he is now?
Yes, he's in charge of the radio research surface as well.
I see.
And he was doing his PhD degree. Farm work with Daniel, a very, very nice chap, by the way. And
I want to try to get a hold of him.
I think he's taken over from Mr. Radcliffe, more or less. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, you were going to talk about
that out for you. Anyway.
Okay. You were talking about the facsimile.
That's right, the facsimile type records. Perhaps you might be interested in a few of the early scenes with that there. It was a beautiful sight. That's black and white picture.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned that I was about to mention when I got, I haven't come to a death, so I'll say for a moment that okay. We've extended the frequency of the spectrograph downwards, and now I'm talking about the interferometer, and there's a photograph of the type of record that we had.
Oh yes.
It's a look at the facsimile, Chartman of a big storm going through, and we have all these records going through.
Running up to the ceiling.
It was quite exciting to watch this just rolling off like that, and realizing just how much work there was between using it. But nevertheless, the direct approach, the instant real-time record was mm-hmm. a great assistance. And here are the receivers now, of the spectrum.
Are all of these bands then frequency bands that I'm seeing here?
They're the interference fringes.
Oh, well, that's right. This is with the interferometer.
On the facsimile, we had two facsimile machines. Eventually, we could put the spectrum on one and the interference on the other. But we also had the film that was going through. And all the photograph of interferometer pattern, and here are the sort of methods of analyzing it. Which all of this is described, of course, in the paper
right.
on by Paul.
The 63 paper.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, I think I was saying that it was very exciting watching these solar bursts coming through, but we also wanted to get as many measurements as possible of on any one particular burst from the one site. We already had the spectrum, we already had position information now from the swift frequency interferometer. So our next step was to introduce a swift phase interferometer by making a mechanical line which was driven from the scanning five meter of the spectrograph. And that was inserted in the local oscillator line of a 30 megahertz oscillator, which mm-hmm. was then the common local oscillator for, I'm sorry, it was a 50 megahertz local oscillator, giving us two reception frequencies of 60 and 40 megahertz. And that traced out the visibility function on a fast pen recorder. And from that record, then we also had information on source sizes. And Alan Weiss later on in the paper in 1962 analyzed the visibility functions at two spacings and at two frequencies for the various classification bursts.
Right.
That I think was the end perhaps of the development of the metric wave equipment and the decametric wave. The other significant development was the move to higher frequencies. We had extended the observations right down to the ionosphere cutoff, and the plan, of course, was always to get wide band observations. So the next logical step was to develop swift frequency techniques which would take us higher and higher. Of course, there were many spectrographs in the world at that time that were measuring higher. There were Maxwell's.
Michigan.
Davis went, I think, to 2,000. They had a gap, I think, between 580 and maybe 1,000 or something like that. And Haddock also had one. But we looked for a different type of receiver, and at that stage we had the assistance of Dr. Suzuki, who had joined us. He came out from Japan. And so his project was to develop a broadband parametric system, or in those days it was just a broad, could we make a 10 to 1 or something frequency range. We knew like periodic aerials had become practical in that time, so we knew the aerial part was possible. Could we make one receiver which would save all these 2 to 1 frequency ranges,
mm-hmm.
which were very difficult to keep going and to calibrate. And so Suzuki worked on that and developed a log periodic aerial and parametric up converter, which in fact is a broadband system, and we finished up tying it on at the end of the 210, I think, top
mm-hmm.
level of the other spectrograph, and going all the way to 2000. And
so you had a range of a factor of 100 then in frequency?
We had a range of, yes, in those days, and several papers. One went into the observatory, and one I think on the equipment that was published in the Institute of Electrical Engineering.
So how many different aerials did you have then? You had the main three and the log periodic for high frequencies.
That's right. Well, here were the original three, covering right. from 42 to about 220. And then we added one down to 40 to 25, 25 to 16, 16 to 10, I think.
Really? So you had four low frequency ones.
Yes, I.
And then three mid frequency, and then the log periodic. So we,
I think, could I just borrow your paper here?
You had a real.
I had a diagram. So here are the ranges.
You had a real antenna farm out there.
5 to 10, 10 to 16, 16 to 25, 25 to 40, 40 to 70.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, then we had this log periodic and the parabolic dish to extend the range right through to 3,000.
And
I was going to say, photograph of Suzuki standing in front of his equipment there.
Oh, yes. There. I'm going to talk to him shortly, so.
I'd like to look at what that would look like in glory to Technicolor.
Oh, great.
That would be pretty spot on.
Well, tell me, what you, at that stage, what you felt the need for in terms of solar bursts.
Well, Paul had always thought in terms of direct images, and in the latter days of Dapto, after his results had been obtained, Paul was looking for the next logical step, which would be some form of two-dimensional imaging. And a lot of the early concepts were discussed at Dapto, and of course Paul then finished that episode by writing a proposal and actually getting money for the hearing aid. We actually carried out a number of the early trials of some of Paul's ideas at Dapto. We didn't know what was the right way to make delay lines and things like that. So, and to make variable ones. We wanted phase changes and all sorts of things. So some of the early experiments were done down here at Dapto. We set up lines and things. As we were prepared to do anything that would work, it didn't really worry us.
This was before you even had the money.
Oh yes, before we had the money, and just to show that some of these things would work. So the initial thoughts were back after Paul had a pretty clear idea as to what he wanted, but the actual method of going about it was not. Well, certainly wasn't clear at all, so we had many discussions about, or think of something and say, could you do this, you see, and he would think along lines like that. And actually in the proposal, when it finally came out, it was really a Heath Robinson sort of proposal. We had all sorts of notices.
What kind?
Or Heath Robinson, that's an Englishman who used to draw cartoons in Punch magazine.
I see.
These complicated machines for pouring drink out of a bottle or something.
There's an American counterpart to that. I can't think of his name, but there, once again, a cartoonist who was famous for this about 50 years ago.
Yes, that's right. So we usually referred to anything that looked a little bit heavy-handed. And of course, finally, when the money came through, we transformed some of those ideas into much more practical things when we were working full time on it. So I suppose really that's that would wind up the Dapto's story.
Well, if I asked you, someone had asked you in the late 50s, what would you call yourself? Would it be a radio engineer or radio astronomer or what?
Yes, I was becoming a radio astronomer.
Yeah, but what would you answer, though, at that time?
Well, I suppose I called myself a physicist then. I had a degree in physics. But I suppose it's an arbitrary sort of thing. I still put down on my income tax physicist.
I see. Okay, well, thank you very much. That is the interview with Sheridan on 7 March 1978.